Hello, my name is Tim Wyatt and you're listening to another episode of Matters of Life and Death, a podcast where I speak with my dad, the doctor, professor of ethics and writer John Wyatt, about how Christians can think more deeply on issues in science, medicine, technology, culture and faith. Today's episode is a little hard to sum up actually. We begin by reflecting on the recent series of scandals around abusive church leaders, before going on to discuss how contemporary culture thinks about sex and power, and in particular how these things are exploited in all human relationships. And then we consider to what extent Christians should become as suspicious of our leaders and their relationships as it seems wider society already is. Hi John, good to speak to you again for another Matters of Life and Death podcast. This week we wanted to start by actually talking about another podcast we've both been listening to and enjoying recently, which I think some of our listeners probably are aware of as well, but it's called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, and it's a fascinating podcast by the American magazine Christianity Today. It's a long series, a long in-depth investigation into the kind of famous or maybe infamous church network Mars Hill, which was led by the pastor Mark Driscoll and then kind of collapsed in acrimony and scandal about 7 or so years ago. But I think what we've found interesting about it, John, I'm interested to hear what you think, is that beyond the immediate and interesting kind of story of Mars Hill and Mark Driscoll, it's really illuminating on some quite recent evangelical history. It's pulled out themes around narcissistic leadership and toxic church culture, celebrity Christianity, but also around the power imbalances around kind of toxic leadership. What stood out for you when you've been listening?
Yeah, you put me in touch with this podcast, Tim, and I must say I've found it a very gripping series. It's very well produced, and it really tells the story of the Mars Hill Church and Mark Driscoll and the role that he played, and it's a fascinating story, but it does bring out a lot of very important and interesting themes about Christian leadership, and in particular about the abuse of power, and the way that it's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? Because you know traditionally it was the Catholic Church which focused power in the person of the priest. And one of the whole emphases of the Reformation was that it took that power away from a man in this special privileged position in the priestly role and put much greater emphasis both on the importance of the Word of God but also on the community together, on body life. And isn't it interesting that it's actually these sort of hyper-reformed groups, some of them like Mark Driscoll's church, who have reinstated this sort of the centrality of the powerful man as the leader of the church.
Yeah, that's actually it's really interesting because I think if you wind the clock back maybe 10 or 15 years ago, as the kind of whole church was waking up to the tragic breadth of the abuse scandal in the Catholic Church in lots of countries, you saw sometimes, I think, some Protestants who were slightly smug or even maybe sneering at the scandals and suggesting it was all in part a result of Catholic theology or church practice, you know, having a single celibate priest as the all-powerful head of a congregation, hierarchies and ecclesiologies and things like that. And I think a sad irony of the last 3 or 4 or 5 years is that we've seen that kind of smugness from Protestants, from evangelicals, is completely misplaced, because every tribe and every flavour of evangelicalism has seen one of its own leaders, its own kind of revered figureheads, exposed as an abuser of power. You know, people will know the names. There's a long litany of them, and Mark Driscoll is sadly just one of many.
Yes, indeed, and I think it has been an extraordinary period, hasn't it, of a constant litany of prominent Christian leaders who some kind of really serious allegations of of either sexual misconduct or of abuse of power, or sometimes a toxic combination of the two, of sex and power.
Yeah, I mean, we've got Jonathan Fletcher, who is this incredibly prominent leader in the conservative evangelical Anglican world, long-time vicar at Emmanuel Wimbledon in South London. Last year, it was Ravi Zacharias, who is this internationally famous evangelist who was revealed as prominent sexual abuser and involved in much sexual misconduct. You had John Smythe, who was heavily involved in the UN Trust youth camps, who it's been revealed that he would regularly and sadistically beat young men in his garden shed. Steve Timmis from the Crowded House, kind of non-denominational evangelical, independent evangelical movement in Sheffield. He was removed over allegations of spiritual abuse a few years ago. People would have heard of the name of Jean Vanier, who's an internationally famous and renowned church leader and theologian who founded the L'Arche movement of homes for those with learning difficulties and those without, living side by side. I think others do as well, quite battered and quite bruised by all of this. I mean, even if these are people I never personally knew, but you just sometimes feel like we're just kind of steeling ourselves for the next beloved and respected Christian leader to be exposed as someone completely different to who they said they were.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think it is incredibly corrosive, isn't it? Because you find yourself looking at prominent names in the Christian world, either of the present or the past, and saying, you wonder, you know, what else? Is it possible that there's some new scandal is about to break at any moment? And so that leads to a sense of suspicion and a failure to trust. And then the question comes, well, how should we respond to this? And certainly, I've been quite troubled by people who have said that perhaps the only response is that we just have to tell everyone, look, we're all fallen. You know, even our leaders, they're all fallen people. They're all deeply sinful. And therefore, you can't trust anybody. You know, you simply have to be aware that abuse and abuse of power and sexual misconduct and so on is everywhere. And therefore, we just can't trust anybody.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, that does actually really kind of chime true for me too in many ways. I mean, as part of my old day job, as it were, I used to spend a lot of time writing stories, news stories about the latest abuse scandals in church, and I even interviewed several victims of clerical sex abuse, and it really does kind of wear you down to the point where it kind of feels like the safest option is to almost presume that nobody is safe. Everyone is potentially guilty until proven innocent in some kind of perverse mirror image of how that's kind of normally supposed to work. Because it just feels too risky to say, I'm sure that person is good, because the very next day, who knows, they could be exposed or done something really, really bad.
Yes, and what I'm particularly interested in is what this does to friendship, and in particular to intergenerational friendship, to friendships between older men and younger men, between older women and younger men, and so on. Because these kind of relationships, so-called Paul Timothy relationships of both genders, have always been at the sort of bedrock of Christian understanding, and also, you know, of Christian practice. That I've been reading some of the letters of John Newton and William Wilberforce and that era, and what's plain is that they had this very rich network of friendships which were incredibly significant, but which went right across the generations and across the sexes. I mean, Newton was having close relationships with young women, with young men, with older women. It was seen as absolutely central to what it meant to follow Christ, to have these deep, intimate friendships.
And yet, you know, when I hear that, or I think when a lot of people hear that, their hackles will start to raise, and we'll be like, "Oh, John Newton, famous Christian leader, had close relationships, close friendships with younger women. That doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem wise. There's something suspect about that.
Yeah, well, I think it's helpful to step backwards. I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm trying to write a book on friendship and actually deal with these issues, both with some of the abuse of friendships that have become very prominent, but also trying to ask, you know, what's the wider cultural context? How can we understand this? And also, how can we then think positively, build up healthy, life-transforming friendships? And I found it's very helpful to think about the concept of what's been called the hermeneutic of suspicion. Hermeneutics, of course, is refers really to the interpretation of manuscripts, of texts, when we talk about biblical hermeneutics and so on. And the hermeneutics of suspicion starts as a kind of literary process, a way of... In other words, when you read a text, an ancient historical text, for instance, you don't just take it at first value, at face value. You apply the hermeneutic of suspicion. You say, I wonder why the author wrote it that way. I wonder what he was trying to hide. I wonder if there's another interpretation. It's that kind of hermeneutic of suspicion. But then the idea comes that we apply this in the whole of life. It's not just when we read a historical text, but we apply the hermeneutic of suspicion to relationships. So we see... as you say, we hear about a relationship between an older man and a younger woman who's not his wife, and immediately the hermeneutic of suspicion says, I wonder what was going on there. You know, was it sexual or was it abusive? Was there some kind of inappropriate behaviour going on there? It doesn't sound right.
And where does that, where do you think that kind of comes from? Where does this hermeneutic of suspicion come from? What are its roots? Why have we become so suspicious and act like that when we hear about these kind of relationships?
Well, it's an interesting process to try and uncover this because it's so universal now that we almost don't think about it. I mean, it's there in the knee-jerk reaction. But I think many people think we can trace it back to some of the very formative influences in Western thinking and Western civilization. And I mean, the basic idea behind the hermeneutic of suspicion is that all relationships are basically motivated by either sex or power or some combination of the two. That's basically what drives relationships. And therefore, in order to understand a relationship, we've got to try and dig out what's driving this. It's either sex or power. So, and many people then trace that to some very prominent thinkers whose thinking has penetrated from the academy and down into everyday life. And of course, one of the most obvious ones is Sigmund Freud.
So a lot of people will have heard that name and know that he's something to do with psychology or psychiatry. But could you explain a little bit about who Freud was and how he came up with this idea that sex and power were at the root of all relationships?
Yeah, Freud is a sort of fascinating character because he's a very respectable neurologist. He's trained as a doctor, but he's prides himself on being the cutting edge of science. But he develops a kind of novel approach to his patients. He's doing private practice in Vienna, and he has the idea that instead of just examining patients and then prescribing medication, he's actually going to listen to them. And so he develops this technique. He has a chaise longue. In fact, interestingly, the Freud Museum is present in North London still, and you can go and visit it. And I've actually seen the original chaise longue, which is there in his study. And what he did was he got the patient to lie down on the chaise longue in a darkened room, and he was up by the head end, out of the patient's view, with a notepad. And he simply asked the patient to talk about their past without interrupting them. And he would just get them to just recall everything they could remember from their past. And he just took notes. And his patients had neurological symptoms, particularly hysteria and neurosis. They were dominated by anxiety or sometimes strange symptoms. And what he found, to his astonishment, as these highly respectable middle-class people from Vienna talked about their past, is that many of them talked about sexual experiences they had as a child, sometimes as a very young child. And initially, he developed the theory that it was some kind of early sexual experience that was the cause of their neurotic symptoms, which was a completely new idea. And he published or presented some papers where he put forward this hypothesis, suggesting that these patients had actually been abused by some adults when they were young children. But not surprisingly,
must have caused a bit of a stir, I imagine, in early 19th, 20th century Vienna.
Absolutely. You can just imagine the response, the horrified response from the respectable burghers of Vienna, that here was this doctor suggesting that some of their precious children from middle-class homes were being subject to abuse from adults, both male and female. And Freud went back, following this rough reception of his ideas, and reinterpreted that actually what was going on was that it was all fantasy. That he came to the conclusion that these were all invented incidents, fantastic incidents that the patient had invented. And he therefore concluded that infantile sexual fantasy was an extremely important part, a motivating part of the way of how all children developed.
So he's basically saying is that rather than genuine experiences, what his patients are recounting to him are their brain making up stories about these sexual experiences. And he concluded that these were kind of normal, healthy, positive parts of how children kind of develop into adults.
Yeah, and in fact, that infants were highly sexual beings. Again, you know, this caused outrage amongst the respectable burghers of Vienna. But what he was saying is that infant who looks so innocent, sucking quietly on the breast, is actually filled with sexual longing and is developing pleasure. They're motivated by libido. And, you know, and therefore he came up with all these ideas. Male infants wanted to possess their mothers and kill their fathers, and female infants were haunted by penis envy. And neurosis and mental illness occurs because of these conflicts, which are all created in these infants.
And this idea, despite being controversial at first, gradually becomes accepted? Does it the consensus?
Well, it's interesting that Freud claimed that this was all entirely scientific, based on you know, strong scientific evidence. In fact, when psychologists later on tried to test these Freudian theories by looking for scientific evidence to support it, by and large, the evidence just hasn't been found. It just isn't there. So from a scientific psychology and child development point of view, these Freudian theories, by and large, have been dismissed. But they've turned out to be immensely influential in psychoanalysis and then through psychoanalysis into the general ideas in general culture.
So you're saying this idea that humans are driven by poorly understood sexual drives and impulses, which colours every relationship we have from childhood onwards, has no scientific basis, but has kind of been smuggled into the culture nonetheless.
Yes, that's right. And I don't want to say it has absolutely no scientific basis, but it certainly doesn't have the dominant scientific evidence that Freud claimed. But these ideas have become very common. And very interestingly, you know, I've gone back and read a bit of Freud, and Freud is quite over that he has a kind of hydraulic metaphor. Because, of course, the late 19th century was the time when steam engines were very, very, that was the most powerful machines around. And Freud conceives of libido as this driving the engine of the psyche. You know, that the energy is like the steam that's driving the engine, and then it's being constrained and repressed by other forces, and sometimes this whole sort of steam, the libido, bursts out with catastrophic consequences. And in order to be a healthy person, you've got to sort of constrain and sublimate the libido. You've got to direct it in healthy areas, so like a safety valve, you know, to remove this excess energy that's building up inside. This is pure hydraulics. And it's interesting, of course, that modern understanding of the way the nervous system is not at all like that at all. It's much more like information processing and communication, and much more like a computer than like a steam engine.
So that's what you think potentially part of the kind of genesis of this idea, the suspicious idea that behind lots of supposedly normal platonic friendships and relationships might actually be lots of kind of strange, complex sexual ideas and longings. What about power?
Yeah, just before we get on power, just two quick points. One is that the whole point that Freud says is that it's all concealed. You know, things which appear to be completely respectable and innocent behaviour is actually all motivated by sex, but it's cleverly concealed. And that's why you have to have the hermeneutic of suspicion. You've got to peel it away. Of course, that's what psychoanalysis was supposed to do. But the other little poignant point I want to make, and that is that 70 years later, and we're now talking the 1960s, 1970s, paediatricians like myself were starting to become aware of the fact that sexual abuse and physical abuse was a real phenomenon, and we hadn't recognised it. And we now know that, unfortunately, both child physical abuse and child sexual abuse is astonishingly common. A very significant percentage of all children have had some kind of abusive experience. And so when you go back and read those accounts of Freud, it seems very likely that many of the patients that he thought were having infantile sexual fantasies had in fact been abused by adults. But it was simply impossible for him and for the respectable V&A's community to acknowledge that. So it's sort of poignant, isn't it, to think of what was going on, and yet it's only very recently that we've been able to acknowledge the level of abuse that goes on between adults and children.
And you kind of feel very much if Freud had been born 100 years later and was presenting his initial theory in our kind of post-Savile world, people would have had much less difficulty accepting the idea that there was widespread abuse of children.
And the whole theory of infantile sexuality and the Oedipal complex and penis envy and everything else might well never have been developed.
So that's sex. How do we understand where this suspicion around power is coming from?
Well, power comes from a different historical background, and particularly I think this is where the figure of Nietzsche, the philosopher, the German philosopher Nietzsche, a very complex and tormented figure. But to put it very crudely, Nietzsche starts a way of thinking which is then taken on by other thinkers, particularly the French philosopher Michel Foucault, that power relations is the way to understand everything. So instead of sex, you've got to think about power, and what Nietzsche is saying is that in the end, power is the only thing that matters. All this thing about finding goodness and morality, finding truth and falsehood, they're all ultimately about power. They're defined by the powerful. And Foucault says, whenever somebody makes a truth claim, whenever they claim this is true, there's always a power relationship. They're always smuggling in because I am powerful, I have the right to say what is true. When I claim something to be true, I'm actually making a claim to power. And these ideas, again, start off as a kind of esoteric philosophical theory, but then they gradually penetrate out into secular culture. And you know, many of us are aware of the whole phenomenon of the woke culture, which has just really emerged in the last few years. And that's a classic example of this kind of analysis, postmodern analysis, that says, if you want to understand society, if you want to understand the relationships, you've got to see it in terms of power. Who are the powerful people? Who are the people who are being oppressed?
I think that's really fascinating to me, because when you do read analysis of what is coming under the label of wokeism or whatever you want to call it, a lot of it is this idea of stripping away some of those kind of bourgeois liberal ideals about individuals and saying, no, it's all about systemic power structures and how in every society there are, you know, the oppressors and the oppressed. And whenever an oppressor says X or Y is a virtuous act, you have to be intensely suspicious, if not outright dismissive, because being, for example, me, you know, a white cis heterosexual male, I've got so much privilege and power that even if I wanted to try and be progressive and that kind of thing, I am slightly constrained by my position and by having power over others. So a lot of it is about trying to tilt the balance and create space for the oppressed and those who do not sit at the top of these overlapping indices of privilege and power, to say, you know, they have the right to decide what is virtuous, what is good, what is moral, and what is not.
Absolutely. And the problem with analysis in terms of power is that really the only response is revolution. So that those who are oppressed should now come out on top and become top dog. The idea of collaboration, of harmony, of is not really, I mean, it's naive, it's simplistic, it doesn't happen. There's always power, there's always going to be oppressors, there's always going to be the oppressed. And, you know, if one just looks at American society in particular and the kind of polarization between right and left, It is a desperate struggle for power, and there's no truck between trying to find compromise. It's simply a constant struggle as to who's going to come out on top.
So this hermeneutic of suspicion is that the idea that lying behind all friendships or relationships, all human interaction, however benign or equal they might seem, the actual forces that play behind them is these complex things about sex and power. But here's the problem, John. We began this podcast talking about Mark Driscoll and Ravi Zacharias, the John Smythes, the Jonathan Fletchers. Don't these people all confirm that the hermeneutic of suspicion was right all along? You know, these were people who were held up as models of Christian witness and leadership, who were supposed to be demonstrating a different way of doing relationship and doing friendship with congregations, with their wives, with mentors, with younger people across the generations. And actually, it turns out we were lied to. There wasn't any kind of agape, self-giving, respectful love there. It was all actually about sex and power as well.
Exactly. And I think that is exactly why these scandals are so profoundly damaging and corrosive, because it's like they just say, aha, we were right all along. You know, it's all about sex and power. That's what all leaders are motivated by, is what they're constantly looking for. They're either looking for sexual gratification, or they're looking for ways of abusing and dominating and oppressing the weak. And so these scandals just accentuate the whole cultural suspicion. And my great concern is that therefore, you know, Christians will conclude it's simply too dangerous, for instance, to have friendships between older men and younger women. It's all between older women and younger men, or between older men and younger men. You know, this is too dangerous. It's going to be misinterpreted. And the safest course is just to say, you know, keep everyone at arm's length. You know, I'm allowed to be close to my wife, I'm allowed to be close to my children, and apart from that, you just keep everyone at arm's length so that we couldn't be misinterpreted.
And that idea, while it seems like quite a modern idea, and I think there will be plenty of people who've adopted it in the kind of wake of these recent scandals, it's not actually totally new. I mean, the Billy Graham rule, which is how he lived and how many other kind of male Christian leaders have also adopted, it says, you know, to never be alone in a room with a woman who's not your wife. And that's how Billy Graham lived his whole ministry. It's how John Stott and many others as well. That fundamentally comes from the same place, doesn't it?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, because I've been reflecting on this and on the scandals, particularly the Jonathan Fletcher scandals, which comes out of the Ewan camp. And the fascinating thing about that era, and, you know, I've been reflecting on my friendship, very close friendship with John Stott, and I'm aware that as soon as I talk about my friendship with John Stott and the fact that we spent many hours alone together and shared some deep, intimate stuff, immediately the hermeneutic of suspicion is active, you know, and what was going on there? And was Stott abusing Wyatt, or was he trying to exert power and manipulate him?
Was Wyatt trying to exploit Scott, you know, to build his burgeoning Christian punditry career?
Yes, quite. Thanks very much. But and of course that's how the hermeneutic of suspicion works. And what strikes me about that generation, and I think, you know, you said it exactly about Billy Graham, is that although they were completely obsessed about any hint of heterosexual impropriety, when it came to the possibility of homosexual same-sex attraction, they were seemed to be completely heedless. I mean, Stott was not at all concerned about being alone with young men. Sometimes when he was travelling, he even shared bedrooms with them, apparently. And this was... nobody raised an eyebrow or even thought how it might appear. And yet they came out of a public school culture where it was well known that homoerotic behaviour, you know, was taking place in some of the schools. And so it's not as though they were unaware of the possibility of same-sex attraction.
And that's what seems remarkable when you look back on, as you say, they had a laser focus on affairs. You know, I think that came from a good place. I mean, when Billy Graham made his famous rule at the start of his ministry in the early 1950s, I think there had actually just been several famous early kind of televangelists or traveling kind of gospel ministers who had had affairs and kind of ruined their ministries and besmirched the gospel. And sadly, even to this day, you know, we know it's not uncommon for men, for Christian leaders to have affairs with people who are not their wives. But given that they came from this British upper class, public school, kind of muscular Christianity world, I do find it remarkable that they didn't consider that to be something to be aware of, you know, in the possibility of same-sex issues, particularly between kind of older and younger men.
And I think there was a level of naivety in that they, I think, believed, I think people like Stott and others would believe that it was simply unconscionable that a Christian leader might abuse his position, even if he was same-sex attracted, and therefore there was no need to put in special safeguards. And I think, you know, now knowing what we know, that seems extraordinarily naive and heedless.
So what are we kind of concluding here? I mean, you seem to be saying that the hermeneutic of suspicion is bad, but that also we probably need a little bit more of it in church.
Yes, well, I think we can't unlearn what we've learnt, and nor should we, or try to ignore it. And of course, we must remember that what the abuse scandals have demonstrated is the terrible level of damage that abuse from Christian leaders, the permanent damage that it causes to other people, particularly to people, young Christians and others who've been influenced by their ministry. And one of the really interesting but tragic aspects of the Mars Hill podcast, isn't it? Is the way that the journalists, the investigators, they want to be honest about the fact that Mark Driscoll and the Mars Hill Church, you know, that there was obvious, genuine spiritual impact on people's lives, positive impact, and yet at the same time, when the whole thing sort of auto-destructs because of Mark Driscoll's behaviour, that many people who've been deeply influenced by him end up as spiritual casualties, deeply hurt and traumatised because of their experiences.
And this is the really tragic part of when you read some of the stories from the victims and survivors of those names that we talked about, who were instrumental in exposing them by bravely coming forward and telling their own stories at huge personal cost. It's had a devastating impact on a lot of people who are victims of abusive Christian leaders. They end up, you know, losing their faith, and who can blame them? You know, when the person who was supposed to be loving them as God does ends up actually hurting them. I guess another complicated issue is it also has an effect on everyone who ever looked up to them, you know, who put Jonathan Fletcher or Ravi Zacharias on a pedestal and said, that's an example of what I want to aim for. Or they've taught me in a remarkable way about who God is and what it means to follow him. And suddenly it's kind of so complex when it turns out actually they're not the person that you thought they were.
Yes, and so I think one of the obvious take-home messages from all this is that we've really got to avoid the pedestal syndrome, which seems to be very, very strong in so many churches, this desire to put one or few people in some very exalted position. We treat them with exaggerated respect. We regard them as having a very, very profound spiritual authority. And yet, as soon as any kind of scandal breaks, then immediately they're then cast into outer darkness. We eradicate their books from our shelves. We remove them from the internet. They're non-persons. There's a very black and white approach, which, and of course, reality is much more complex and nuanced than that.
I mean, I think you've said this before, and I think it's right. One of the besetting sins of evangelicalism is this insistence on making everything black and white, and everything falls into the category of good, sound, or true, or it must be bad, unsound, and untrue. And we've been discovering, like many things in life, people can't so easily be categorised like that. You know. I mean, I've read a book by Mark Driscoll, which at the time I found it really good and helpful exposition about the theology of the cross. You know, should I burn that book now or expunge it from my memory because I kind of now understand what a narcissistic, bullying character he was? You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously it certainly colours how I would read the book again, but I'm not sure we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say he was a bad man and therefore everything he did was also bad and he was never really a Christian anyway and everyone who has been impacted by him needs to kind of expunge him from their soul.
Yeah, so I think what we need to do is first of all be much more careful about how we choose our leaders, and that's so often what's happened in the recent Christian history is leaders have been selected and come to prominence because of their gifts, their vision, their ability to persuade people, their ability to raise money, and so on. And that's absolutely clear about Mark Driscoll. He was clearly a very gifted, very charismatic in the non-spiritual sense, able to sway thousands of people by his oratory and so on. And yet, it's clear, I mean, he was a very young, he had obvious character flaws, he was a deeply damaged person. And it's very interesting, as has often been said, that in the New Testament, the criteria for leaders is almost entirely based on character, not on giftedness. I mean, the emphasis in selecting leaders is all about character. And I think we need to rediscover that and put much more emphasis on character and on assessing people's character and looking for evidence of maturity and identifying character flaws rather than being bamboozled by people who are astonishingly gifted.
Yeah, and I think for me, that's one of the big takeaways from the Mars Hill podcast, the idea that people were kind of blinded by his charisma and his gifting, but he actually lacked the integrity and what we need first and foremost in our leaders is character and kind of gifting, because it's secondary to that. So just as we kind of move towards a kind of final thought, what we're saying, I guess, is that absolutely we can't and we don't want to unlearn what we've learned. We definitely need to be a lot wiser and less complacent than early generations. But you would be very reluctant to go further than that and to be saying cross-generational or even cross-gender friendships are just too difficult or risky and we should just steer away from them entirely within church.
Absolutely. In fact, I want to do quite the reverse. I want to encourage people, particularly older people, to go out of their way to be developing cross-generational friendships with younger people, very much as a two-way process of both giving and learning. But we need to teach people about friendship. We need to teach people about what the warning signs are, where it becomes abusive. One of the fascinating things to me that came out of the Mars Hill podcast is how frequently Mark Driscoll insisted on utter loyalty from his team and from his church members, and it was reiterated, unless you are totally loyal to me, then you're out, I'm not interested. And that should have been a massive red flag. I mean, any leader who insists on complete and utter loyalty should immediately raise question marks. And the same was true about Jonathan Fletcher. Apparently it's reported again that he insisted on complete and utter loyalty from the people that lived for them. And then the question is, well, why? Is that because of concern that they will see flaws in the character and their behaviour and that this will then ruin their image? So, and I think there are other red flags as well, which we need to educate people that about the ways that friendship go wrong. But that doesn't mean that friendship itself between generations is wrong or dangerous, and quite the reverse. And so trying to find healthy ways of building healthy, transformative friendships that are mutually giving, that are not based on sex and power. They don't have to be. They can be based on love and self-sacrifice. And what I think of as the logic of the gospel, the fact that the gospel is based on the breaking down of barriers, on self-giving to the other, on respect, on honesty, on openness, and on love.
And there's just so much more we could say, you know, about what true Christian friendship looks like outside of the hermeneutic of suspicion. And I guess we're gonna hope to come back to that in a further podcast. You're obviously still researching and writing this book on friendship, so there's going to be loads of material you'll want to share. And I think it's an important topic that we should come back to. I mean, it's such a big theme in the New Testament. Jesus talks about how I no longer call you servants, but friends, and greater love has no one than he that he lays down his life for his friends. And there's a real theme of friendship there, which I think we often skate over. And we talk about being brothers and sisters and use kind of the familial family metaphor, but actually the language of friendship is really central to the gospel.
Yeah, and so the real challenge for us as 21st century Christians is how can we reimagine friendship in the light of all this hermeneutic of suspicion, in the light of these terrible scandals? How can we reimagine Christian friendship in a way that is true to the gospel, that is true to the Spirit, and yet which is aware of the risks and the dangers which we now are so painfully aware. So I hope that you know, we can carry on the conversation. I hope maybe that some people who are listening to this podcast will respond, and we can be all part of this conversation as we try to work out how friendship can be reimagined as we look into the future.
Definitely. Well, let's just draw it to a close there. Just a quick reminder that if you would like to get in touch with us, you can just send us an email. It's mattersoflifeanddeathpodcast@gmail.com. And looking forward to speaking to you again soon, John.
Great. Thanks very much.
That's it for this episode of Matters of Life and Death. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do share it with friends or on social media. It can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or all other major podcast apps. As always, don't forget to check out John's website, which has plenty more resources to read, listen to, and watch on lots of the things that we've talked about in the podcast and much more besides. You can find it at johnwyatt.com. That's johnwyatt.com. And if for some reason you'd even like to follow me online, I'm at T.S. Wyatt on Twitter, and you can find some of my journalism at tswyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing mattersoflifeanddeathpodcast@gmail.com or just send me a tweet. We're always keen to hear from listeners, especially if you have a question to ask, a topic you'd like us to explore, or a news development to respond to. The music in the show is, as always, by Daniel Birch. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.